All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is Monday, April 27th. And we're going to start a new chapter today, which is the circulation, blood vessels. Here's a sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And so what we're covering today through the rest of the class will be on your last test. And I don't have the schedule of classes with me, but according to my syllabus, I have our final on May 18th, 10:30 to 12:30. I should double check that to be sure, because sometimes you can kind of lose your way reading that schedule's final, or the final schedule in the scheduled classes, but you all might just want to check, make sure, and confirm that's the correct date. If not, I'll make another. I think it's probably fairly correct. Okay, so May 18th. And what is that, a Monday? That's a Monday. Okay. 10:30 to 12:30. All right, so we're going to start the circulatory system today. And you had a test last week. I can't remember when it was. Was it Wednesday? Yeah, okay, so your grades are posted. And if you want to check your test out, maybe come see me during office hours, something like that. And I'll be happy to go over that with you. All right, I'm going to turn some of these lights off so we can see the screen a little bit better. Is that too dark? No, that's good, huh? All right. All right, so circulatory system. Blood vessels obviously carry blood. And you should know that there are two circulatory systems, right? Because we just got done talking about the heart. What are the two circulatory systems? The systemic and the pulmonary. And then furthermore, you should be able to break down a blood vessel into maybe three major components, three different kinds of blood vessels, and what a definition is. So the first kind is a blood vessel that takes blood away from the heart, and we call that an artery. All right, then there's a blood vessel that brings blood back to the heart, that's a vein, and then there's another blood vessel that's in between the two. And that's special because something special is happening there. What's the name of that blood vessel? That's a capillary. What's special about that blood vessel? Exchange can take place. And now you're going to see on the slide that I'm about to show you why exchange can take place in a capillary. Okay. So when we study anatomy, and even clinically, we're always very interested in layers. That's one of the things that students in anatomy really aren't too interested in because they don't know how important it is clinically. All right, but nonetheless, blood vessels have layers in them, and we got to know what the different layers are because this is where pathology develops. And we'll be learning more and more about these layers and pathology through our lifetimes, and hopefully we'll be able to deal with vascular disease by understanding these layers and how they misbehave. Okay, so a blood vessel has three main layers, or at least most blood vessels have three main layers. There's the tunica externa. All right, so what does tunic mean? What does tunic mean? A tunic means a coat or a wrapping. All right, so it used to be when it's cold outside, you would put on a tunic and that would keep you warm. All right, so a tunic is just a coat. It's a wrapping around the blood vessel. Tunica externa, guess which layer that is? That's, yeah, the most superficial layer, right, the externa. And then the tunica media, guess which one that is? That's the one in the middle, and then tunica intima, that's the deepest layer. All right, that's the one that's in contact with blood. And we can see that the tunica externa has strong connective tissue. It has longitudinal collagen and elastic fibers. So when we say longitudinal, what does that mean? Does that mean wrapping around in a circle or going the length of the blood vessel? The length, that's right, going the length of the blood vessel. And elastic tissue, what does that mean? What can these vessels do? Yeah, they can stretch, and then when that pressure goes away, guess what happens to them? They go back to their normal position. So that helps keep blood flowing in arteries. All right. So this connective tissue and elastic tissue strengthens the wall and also anchors the vessel in the surroundings because you don't want your blood vessels moving around inside your arms and legs. And even in some very large blood vessels that have very thick walls, the walls of the blood vessels themselves need their own blood supply because that blood vessel is an organ And that blood supply that is actually nourishing a blood vessel because it's so thick is called the vasa vasorum.
This so is where is that blood coming from?
That's coming from, it's coming from arteries. Yeah, it's arterial blood. That's bringing oxygen and nutrients. So there are little branches going and feeding the whole wall thickness. Okay, so let's take a look at a representation of these three kinds of blood vessels that we see right here. So here we have blood. Let's just pretend the heart is up over in this area right here. So blood is leaving the heart. So this is an artery. And blood then is returning to the heart via these veins right here. Notice how thick this artery is. It's very thick. It has all those different layers in it, right? So so here is the externa right here that has the elastic and connective tissue. Right here is the elastic part of the externa. And then the middle layer right here, tunica media, and you see that it looks very thick, and it also looks red. Guess what kind of tissue that is? That's actually muscle tissue, right? That's smooth muscle tissue. And then the deepest layer, the tunica intima right here, is the inside lining of the blood vessel. That's, now, what do we call a tissue that covers a surface or lines a cavity? Yeah, epithelium, typically, right? Epithelium is one of the four kinds of tissues. But if it's lining a cavity like this blood vessel, instead of calling it epithelium, we just call it an endothelium because it's lining a blood vessel, all right? So this particular epithelium, and remember, you can characterize epithelium a number of different ways by the shape of the cells. What's your favorite shape? Squamous, okay, flat, just for fun. You could say squamous, right? That's the flat kind of cell. Well, we can also characterize epithelium by what? Not just the shape of the cells, but by the layers, right? So this endothelium that lines every blood vessel and actually lines every inside chamber of the heart is just a simple squamous epithelium. So how many layers is it? Just one, right? Just one, we say simple. All right, and that endothelium is very smooth, so blood flows over the endothelium very easily. Doesn't form blood clots, as long as it's a healthy blood vessel. If there's disease in that blood vessel, then it might have some rough spots. In which case, what could happen then? Maybe there's some calcium plaques or cholesterol plaques that are poking into the bloodstream that can form blood clots, and then that blood clot can go to various parts of your body, like your brain, and cause a stroke, or your heart and cause a heart attack. Okay, so that's why we're interested in knowing something about all these different layers right here. Okay, so this might be an exam figure. I don't have it on the tip of my tongue. Is this an exam figure?
Yeah,
I bet it is. Okay, so that's an artery. And arteries have the highest pressure. They're receiving blood from the heart. Now, how does a fluid flow? And a fluid could be a liquid or it could be a gas. It could be, you know, like our atmosphere right here. How is a fluid going to flow? There's something that's going to be the force that drives fluid in motion. What can drive fluid in motion? Somebody, I thought I saw somebody say it, but I'm not sure. It is pressure. Pressure will drive fluid. Now, how will fluid move according to pressure? Yeah, the direction is always going to be from high pressure to low pressure. And if there's no pressure difference, then the fluid is not going to flow. So blood can only flow from high pressure to low pressure. So which way does blood flow? From an artery to a vein or from a vein to an artery? Artery to a vein. So which one has got to have the highest pressure? Arteries, because blood can only flow from high pressure to low pressure. All right, so that's why blood is being driven down this artery, and then it's going to branch into a very small artery we call an arteriole, and then eventually get to this very, very small, tiny vessel. These are microscopic vessels, and these only have the tunica intima, which is a basement membrane, which is very, very thin. On this illustration, it's a lot thicker than it actually is, and then the endothelium. Right, and that's just a simple squamous epithelium that lines a blood vessel. So what can you tell me about the thickness of this capillary compared to the thickness of an artery? Which is it obvious which one is thicker? Yeah? Okay, namely the artery. The arteries are so thick because of all the connective tissue, elastic tissue, and muscle layers that nothing can leak out and nothing can penetrate the wall of an artery, so exchange cannot take place. But when we look at a capillary, look how thin that blood vessel is. Material can actually move through that capillary wall by diffusion, and pressure of that blood vessel will even force some fluid out. So exchange can take place in a capillary, but not an artery, right? And using that same line of thinking, look at this vein right here. Does it look thick or thin compared to this capillary? I see, I heard thick and thin. But when I look at this vein, it has all the layers. It's got tunica externa, tunica media, tunica intima, right? So again, it's very thick compared to this capillary. So exchange cannot take place in a vein either because it's way too thick. So where is there only one place where things can enter or leave the circulatory system? Yeah, only in capillaries. So for instance, if you have oxygen that's in this artery, it's trapped in that artery. It can't get out. Where is the only place that oxygen can leave the circulatory system? Is in that capillary right there. Okay, and so that's why tissues have these networks of capillaries right here. So this is what we would call actually a capillary bed, and that capillary bed is nourishing all the cells of this area right here. Okay, so types of blood vessels. Arteries, takes blood away from the heart, that definition you know by heart now. Now arteries may be oxygenated or deoxygenated, depending on what circulation it is. Could you give me the name of an artery that's carrying deoxygenated blood? The pulmonary artery, right? Because the pulmonary artery is going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. Okay, so that shouldn't be too hard to figure out. Highest blood pressure. The elastic layer is found in very large arteries that we call conducting arteries near the heart. So for instance, give me an example of two arteries that can expand, all right, and then go back to their normal shape, expand when the heart pumps blood, and then go back down to their normal shape when the heart relaxes during diastole. What kind of arteries have that elastic property? The aorta and the pulmonary trunk and pulmonary arteries can expand and collapse back down. Okay, because remember, your heart isn't contracting all the time. It only contracts during systole and then it relaxes. And then as the aorta shrinks back down, that helps propel blood through your arteries even though the heart is relaxing, even though the heart is in diastole. Okay, the muscle layer in medium and small arteries. Now, medium and small arteries are what we call distributing arteries because they don't have a lot of elastic tissue, but they do have a lot of muscle tissue. They can vasodilate and vasoconstrict. So what do we mean by that? Vasoconstriction means that if I'm showing you the diameter of a blood vessel, vasoconstriction means that the diameter gets very small. Vasodilation means that the diameter can get large. And that is very important because that can change blood flow through that particular blood vessel. And that diameter is controlled by the sympathetic nervous system. Is that ringing a bell? Mm-hmm. Okay, tell me something about the sympathetic nervous system. Yeah, it controls blood vessels. What else can it control? Your heart rate. What's it going to do to heart rate, for instance? It's going to speed up heart rate and also force of contraction. Right. Okay. Now here is something interesting about knowing something about vasoconstriction and vasodilation. It's a very powerful way that your body can control blood flow to various parts of your body. All right, so for instance, let's start with a diameter of 1 millimeter, centimeter, or whatever. And if we measure the flow, let's just say that we measured a blood flow of 1, maybe a milliliter per minute or something. That would be the flow. Okay, and now let's go from a diameter of 1 to 2. What are we doing? Are we vasoconstricting or vasodilating? Yeah, we're vasodilating, all right, by a factor of 2. All right, now let's look at the blood flow. And now we measure the blood flow. It has changed by a factor of 16. Right? We change the diameter a factor of 2, but blood flow changed by a factor of 16. Can you see that blood flow changes much more rapidly compared to the amount that we change the diameter? Right? And that's because of the fourth power rule. How can we get from 2, a factor of 2, to a factor of 16? The fourth power just means if we look at that vessel diameter and raise it to the fourth power, that's how we calculate the flow. So, for instance, how would we calculate the fourth power of 2? It would be 2 times 2, which is 4, times 2 is 8, but you stop there? Nope. One more time, times 2 is 16. So by small changes in vasoconstriction or vasodilation, your body can institute major changes in blood flow, and it can direct blood flow to various parts of your body or turn it off, depending on what parts of your body are being used. And this last number over here just kind of illustrates that same concept, and that is if we change the diameter of a blood vessel by a factor of 5, look how the blood flow changes by a factor of 625, a huge amount, right? So just small changes in vasoconstriction and vasodilation correspond to huge changes in blood flow through a tissue, yeah. Oh, it's the pressure doesn't matter, just the diameter of the blood vessel, vasoconstriction or vasodilation, okay? So let's keep the pressure the same. Keep pressure the same, just vasoconstrict and vasodilate, okay? Okay. Okay, arterioles are just small arteries, right? And their specialized function is to regulate blood flow, so they even have more smooth muscle that can constrict for vasoconstriction or vasodilation. All right, and they can be controlled by metabolism of the cells that they are feeding blood to or by the nervous system, namely the sympathetic nervous system, one or the other. So if you start to exercise a muscle, guess what that muscle is going to be using up? It's going to be using up energy. It's going to be using up ATP, maybe producing ADP, maybe producing lactic acid, and that's going to change the pH of that muscle. Lactic acid and pH will affect these arterioles, causing them to vasodilate. And when they vasodilate, what happens to blood flow to that muscle? It increases. How much does it increase? Just a little bit or what? Yeah, by the fourth power, the change of the diameter of that blood vessel. So it goes way up, and so that maintains the health of that muscle when it's exercising. Okay, there's something else too. And that is a precapillary sphincter. All right? Way back when we were looking at skeletal muscles, we learned something about the orbicularis oculi. What's the orbicularis oculi? That's a muscle where? That's the winking muscle, yeah, around your eye. Or the orbicularis oris. That's what closes your mouth, right? Okay, those are circular skeletal muscles. All right, a sphincter, on the other hand, is a circular muscle, but it's a smooth muscle. So you don't have voluntary control of it, but it can, like, close your eyes, all right, or it can dilate. And so it can either open or close, all right, the entrance to a capillary. It can allow blood to flow into a capillary, or it can turn off blood flow to a capillary. Okay, so we would see precapillary sphincters, for instance, like right here in that diagram. All right, so here's some histology. So here, for instance, is a slide that shows what a nice artery and a vein and an arteriole. And then this is the entrance to a capillary bed. And look what's right at the entrance to that capillary bed right here. That's a precapillary sphincter. And these respond to the metabolism of these cells right here. They are not innervated, so the sympathetic nervous system doesn't control them. So if this is a highly metabolic tissue, right, then those precapillary sphincters are going to be dilated. That's going to allow blood to feed those tissues. But if these tissues are quiet, like for instance muscle when you're asleep, you don't contract muscle, then these precapillary sphincters are constricted, and that's cutting off blood supply to those muscles because they don't need blood when they're not exercising. All right, so this is another very important control element. Now, is this an active or passive mechanism? Okay. All right, so active means that it needs energy. Passive means it does not need energy. So what kind of cells are making these precapillary sphincters? Smooth muscle. What does muscle need to contract? ATP. Right? So if it needs energy, again, is that active or passive? It's active. That's right. So these precapillary sphincters are important because they require energy when they constrict, when they contract. We're going to look at, now what about valves in the heart? What are valves in the heart made out of? What layer of the heart? I don't know if that was a question on the test last time or not, but that would have been a good one. Yeah, the valves, remember, what are the three main layers of the heart again? Well, on the outside, it's the, you got the epicardium on the outside, which is what, the visceral pericardium, it's the same. And then what's the middle layer? That's the myocardium. And what's the inner layer? Endocardium. That's right, that's an epithelium that's lining the inside of the heart. And that's the layer that blood that the valves of the heart are made out of, endocardium. Okay, now, what layer of the heart contracts? The myocardium. What about the endocardium? It's just an epithelium. It's just a layer of epithelium. Doesn't require a lot of energy. So how do the valves in the heart work? Do they require energy to close and open? No, they just do it passively because of pressure differences between, for instance, the atria and the ventricles. All right, so the way blood flow is regulated in the heart because of those valves is totally different than the way these precapillary sphincters work, right? These precapillary sphincters work by active constriction or dilation. Okay. All right, so capillary, don't forget, smallest blood vessel. It just has a thin layer, so that allows for exchange, just the endothelium. Now, there are three kinds of capillaries by structure, and that allows for a different amount of leakiness. So fluid does leak out of a capillary. All right, so let me show you the three different kinds. You got continuous, fenestrated, and sinusoidal. All right, here are the three different kinds of capillaries. All right, and you can just see what, the endothelial cells right here, and you can see the basement membrane. This is a little bit better illustration. The basement membrane is very, very thin. So here we have red blood cells and plasma. This one right here is what we call a continuous capillary. All right, most of the cells that make up the endothelium come very close to their neighboring cells. Right, but nonetheless, there still is an intercellular cleft between them. So there is a space between them, and guess what can leak out of that space right there? Plasma, okay, but and nutrients and oxygen can diffuse through that space, but that's okay because that's what we would like to have a capillary do, right? Nourished tissues, for instance. Now, what can't sneak through here are cells. The cells are way too big. So the red blood cells stay inside the blood vessel as well as platelets. But these little spaces right here are even big enough to even allow white blood cells to crawl through them. They can sneak past these intercellular clefts. Okay. All right, so that's a continuous. The next kind is a fenestrated. And what a fenestrated means, it means that it has like little windows in the endothelial lining. And so here you can see the fenestrations. It has the intercellular clefts that are a little bit bigger, right? And but it has these fenestrations, which are holes through the cells of the endothelium. So is this kind of capillary more leaky or less leaky than continuous? Or even more leaky, right? Certain parts of your body need to have more plasma flowing out, and this is the kind of capillary that's used. And then here's the third kind. This is what we call a sinusoidal kind of capillary, because look at the spaces, look at the holes within the endothelium. They're what? They look gigantic. Not gigantic enough for red blood cells to leak out, but almost. So this is the leakiest kind of capillary. This is the kind that allows for the most exchange to take place. All right, and we're going to see where some of these kinds of capillaries are. All right, so those are the three kinds of capillaries in order of their leakiness. So probably you should remember that order of leakiness. And then capillaries Let me go back. Capillaries. All right. So here are all the branches of capillaries, and they're going to join with bigger and bigger capillaries and finally coalesce into this venule right here. All right, so we say that when an artery breaks down into various branches, all right, that's what we call a bifurcation, when an artery branches off. All right, but when blood vessels come together to form a bigger single vessel, that's not a branch, that's what we call anastomosis. Right? Anastomosis. So the anastomosis is sort of like a bifurcation, except blood is flowing the other direction. All right? So these are all anastomoses over here, and these are what? Bifurcations over here. So when blood vessels come back together, flow joins each other, that's an anastomosis. And that's kind of a hallmark of the venous system, where small veins join to form a bigger vein. That would be an anastomosis. Okay, so veins bring blood back to the heart. That's just a standard definition. Okay, now I got a kind of a tricky question for you. What kind of blood vessel has the highest pressure?
Artery.
What kind of blood vessel has the lowest pressure? And everybody said the right answer. That's really good. Because a lot of times when you first start studying anatomy, because capillaries are the most functional part of the circulatory system, because that's where exchange takes place, a lot of people think, well, capillaries are the place that have the lowest blood pressure. Okay? But that's not true. Because if that were true, let's go back to this right here, if capillaries had the lowest pressure, right, what would happen to this venous blood? Blood in the veins. Which way would it go? Would it go back to the heart? It would actually flow into a capillary if capillaries had the lowest pressure. Remember, blood always flows from high pressure to low. All right, so if capillaries had the lowest pressure, blood would flow into capillaries. And what about arteries? Don't forget, blood always flows from high pressure to low. What vessel has the highest pressure? Arteries, so... Right? Blood would also flow from arteries into capillaries if capillaries had the lowest pressure. So where would all the blood end up?
In capillaries.
It wouldn't go back to your heart. So capillaries can't have the lowest pressure. Otherwise, all the blood would go there, and capillaries would get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then what would happen? Well, you just blow up like a water balloon or something. Okay? I'm just sort of kidding with that. But you wouldn't blow up, but it wouldn't work. Right? Maybe some of the capillaries would blow up. All right, so... capillaries still have a higher pressure than veins, and that's what drives blood from capillaries into the veins, because veins have the lowest pressure. All right, now how does, you might ask, all right, well, if veins have the lowest pressure, how does blood get back to the heart? Okay, because veins have the lowest pressure, how does it get back to the heart? There are two kinds of pumps that help pump blood that's in veins back to the heart. All right, and... let me see if I can show you something about veins. Ah, here's a good slide. Oh, let me go back to this one, actually. Okay. So here is a vein. It's thick, but not as thick as an artery. But a vein has another kind of structure that's similar to what we see in the heart, but we don't see these structures in arteries and capillaries. Can you see these little flaps right here? Guess what those little flaps are? Those are valves, and they're made from... can you see the layer? The endothelium, just like the valves of the heart. All right. And so veins have valves. Capillaries and arteries don't have valves. But veins have valves so that it allows, what does a valve allow, blood? It prevents backflow, prevents retrograde flow. Right. So that blood can only flow back to the heart once it's in a vein, because if it starts to go backwards, it inflates these valves and they close that vein, as long as it's a healthy vein. If it's not a healthy vein, sometimes veins, as they get more diseased, they start to get bigger, they dilate, they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and guess what happens to the valves then? They can't close. Okay, and so now blood has a tendency to be trapped in your extremities. And that's really bad, because when blood is trapped someplace, it likes to form a clot, right? So healthy veins have to be the right diameter so that the valves can touch each other and then close properly, just like valves inside the heart. And these valves are made out of what layer? Maybe I asked you. The endothelium, right, of the veins right here. Okay. So how is it that blood gets back to the heart in veins? Well, here we have a couple muscles that are on either side of this vein. And when you contract a muscle, it expands and it pushes on the veins in that area. And it pressurizes the blood in this segment right here. And so it's going to want to squirt away from those muscles that are contracting. Which way is it going to squirt? If it's a healthy vein, only back to the heart, because this valve right here is preventing retrograde flow down to your extremity, right? As long as it's a healthy vein. If it's not a healthy vein, then indeed blood will flow retrograde in that vein and it's going to be dangerous, right? So that's the purpose of these veins. That's number one. We call that the skeletal muscle pump. So what is one way to prevent pooling of blood in your venous system? Is with exercise, right? Exercise is very important. And you know what? If people are trapped in a confined space for hours and hours and hours on end, they don't exercise their skeletal muscles, blood has a tendency to pool in their veins, and that has a tendency to form blood clots, right? And there was, in the last war in Iraq, I think there was a news reporter that died as a result of that. He didn't want to get out of his Humvee, his armored vehicle, and he was just sitting in there for about a week, and a blood clot formed in an extremity, and it went through his, vena cava, went through the right side of his heart into his pulmonary artery, and where does it go from the pulmonary artery? It branches into smaller and smaller and smaller blood vessels, finally into the lungs, right, where there's capillaries, and it got stuck in his lungs. And we call that a pulmonary embolism, and it was a major part of his lung died, and that actually caused his death, pulmonary embolism. Yeah.
When you talk about,
like, when a vein, you know, that's kind of just kind of slang talking. So when a vein is blown, you know, because there is smooth muscle in these veins right here, and whenever you start poking around in there with a needle or whatever, that smooth muscle is going to get irritated and it's going to constrict. And so that might be one thing that's causing a blown vein. The vessel is just so traumatized that it's constricted, and now it's really hard to introduce a needle into it because it's so small. Another thing that might happen when you're digging around with a needle in there, you might actually rip the blood vessel, right, because it's not as strong as an artery. And if it's all ripped apart, okay, again, you don't have a place to stick a needle, right? So it could be due to a lot of different kinds of things. Maybe it's just torn, or maybe it's just constricted. And then when it scars, then it's not going to have the same kind of shape anymore. Okay, so probably that a blown vein could have a lot of different connotations to it. Okay, so even when you're getting IVs or getting blood drawn, go to somebody that's done it like a million times, right? So they could do it in their sleep with their eyes closed. That's always the best, okay? Of course, you don't always know that, right? When you go get your blood drawn, have you ever asked anybody, how many times have you done this? Never. You might want to just ask and just kind of chuckle sometime, okay? Okay. So this is one pump. That's a skeletal muscle pump. There's another pump, too, that works. I don't think I have a slide on this one. So I'll just have to describe it to you. All right, when you breathe, all right, how do you get air inside your lungs? And we're going to talk about this. Maybe you've talked about it in lab, maybe just a little bit. In order to get air inside your lungs, you have to expand your rib cage. There are muscles that depress, well, the diaphragm depresses, all right, that expands your thoracic cavity. You also have muscles that expand your rib cage up and out. So that increases the volume of your thoracic cavity. And when the volume increases, the pressure goes way down, right? So when you increase the thoracic cavity volume, pressure goes way down. And so how does fluid flow again? From high pressure to low pressure. When you decrease the volume inside your chest, guess what flows through your nose? Air. Because it's going from high pressure in the atmosphere to low pressure in your thoracic cavity. So air is being sucked into your lungs because you've expanded your rib cage. All right? But not only air gets sucked into your lungs, when you expand your rib cage, the pressure everywhere decreases. What else is being sucked into your thoracic cavity. Not just air, but blood as well is actually being sucked into your thoracic cavity when the pressure decreases. We call that the respiratory pump or the respiratory pump. So every time you take an inhalation, that helps return blood from your periphery to your thoracic cavity, right? And then when you exhale, that increases the pressure. Does the blood go out? Does the blood leave your thoracic cavity when you pressurize your chest? Why can't blood leave your thoracic cavity? Why can't blood flow backwards in a vein? Because they have valves, okay? And what kind of valves are these? Are these active or passive valves? Okay. What did we see that was active just a little while ago? The sphincter. What was the sphincter made out of?
Smooth
muscle that was forming a ring. Okay, it was forming a ring. Smooth muscle forming a ring. Now, what about these valves right here? What are they made out of? Smooth muscle or what? This is a good check to make sure you have it right in your mind. What are these valves made out of? Just like the valves in the heart. They're made out of endothelium. They're not muscle, so they are what? They're passive. They can't be active, right? So they're just opening and closing depending on the flow of blood through that vein. Okay, so that's just passive closing and opening. Okay, so those are the two kinds of pumps, right? Respiratory pump, skeletal muscle pump that helps return blood from veins back to your heart because there's no pressure in veins, basically. Okay, circulatory system. These are some of the vessels that you have to know. You're probably experts at this already because you've had a lab on the blood vessels that you have to know, but we'll kind of go over this again. All right, and don't forget, how many circulations are there? Pulmonary versus systemic circulation, and probably that's what this slide was all about. Pulmonary versus systemic circulation. This, you know what? Pretty much is just a pulmonary circulation. All right, so here is the RV pumping blood into the pulmonary trunk that bifurcates very soon into the left and right pulmonary arteries. It's colored blue because what's the state of blood there? It is deoxygenated. Okay, now the blood that's being pressurized in the left ventricle going to the systemic circulation is very high. The pressure is high in the left ventricle. It's relatively low in the right ventricle. Does anybody know what the blood pressure should be in the left ventricle? Let's the aorta. A good systemic blood pressure, normal blood pressure should be 120 over 80, and that's millimeters of mercury. Now, why do we give you two numbers? Why do we give you two numbers? Okay, that's because the heart is contracting sometimes and it's relaxing at other times. When it contracts, we call that systole, and when it relaxes, we call that diastole, right? So the first pressure is the systolic pressure, and then the lowest pressure before the heart contracts again is the diastolic, so that's 120 over 80. The blood pressure in the right ventricle is really much lower because it only has to pump blood through the lungs, a much shorter distance. I'm not sure anybody really knows for sure what a normal blood pressure is for the pulmonary system, but it's probably maybe around 25 millimeters of mercury over 15, something like that, way low. All right, so the heart on the right side doesn't have to work nearly as hard as on the left side, and so you could actually see that in lab that the right ventricle is really thin compared to the left because it doesn't have to work nearly as hard at all. Okay. All right, so that's pretty important. Now, don't forget that the circulatory system in terms of what it's carrying is what? Opposite the systemic circulation. So pulmonary arteries are deoxygenated, pulmonary veins are oxygenated. So how would you describe to somebody, a neophyte, that the pulmonary veins are oxygenated? What's a really easy way to think of that? Because why? Okay. Why do the pulmonary veins have oxygen? Why are they high in oxygen? They're coming back from the lungs. And the whole purpose in the lungs is that there's capillaries that allow for exchange to take place in the lungs, right? So blood coming back from the lungs is oxygenated. Okay, so that's pretty much the pulmonary circulation. The systemic circulation, right, is much higher pressure. right? Normal is 120 over 80. What do we call it if somebody's blood pressure is greater than 120 over 80? That's hypertension, right? That's, and now you know, is it pulmonary hypertension or systemic hypertension? Systemic, that's right. So it's so hard to measure pulmonary pressure, we don't even talk about it very much clinically. Okay, and so when somebody says hypertension, we automatically assume it's systemic, all right? And it's not to say that somebody can't get pulmonary hypertension, and that's just as deadly. So that's something I didn't say already, and that is systemic hypertension is deadly as well, and it should be treated. So if you know anybody in your family that has hypertension, you really have to be supportive and make sure that they stay on their medications to bring their blood pressure down. Otherwise, it's going to kill them eventually. It's going to kill their heart, going to kill their kidneys, kill their blood vessels and everything else. So you just got to be really gentle with them, because if you have a loved one that has hypertension and you know they're not on their medication, and if you go, you got to get on your hypertension medication now, what's going to happen to their blood pressure? You got to get on it now or you're going to die. What's going to happen to their blood pressure? Yeah, it's going to go up, right? So you got to be really careful. Yeah.
What is the condition of when someone has a high pressure and then there was that liquid leaking in well, start a high pressure and that's something else?
When they have leaking into their lungs.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly what that is, but that could be pulmonary hypertension. And there's pulmonary, if there's fluid in the lungs, that's pulmonary edema. And if there's fluid in there, then there's no room for air. And then you're not exchanging oxygen. And that usually is a sign of heart failure. And hopefully you caught it early enough to where you can get on some medication to treat it. If it's late stage, then only two possible outcomes. One is you're going to die, or the other is you're going to get a heart and lung transplant. Heart and lung transplant is not anything you want to do. It's better than dying, but what's even better? Treat it before it becomes really serious, right? And even systemic hypertension can lead to pulmonary hypertension. So that's another important reason to be on medication and support people that have hypertension so they don't get to that place to where they need a heart transplant. Right? It's like the last thing you want to go through. Okay? All right, so let's talk about some divisions of blood vessels. Okay, so the left ventricle is pumping blood into the aorta, right? And the aorta is that archy thing. Do I have an aorta around someplace? Yeah, right here. Here we can see, what division of the aorta is this right here? This is the ascending aorta, and then here is the arch, and then here is the descending, which you have to kind of use your imagination for to see a little bit. But it goes through what? The thoracic cavity and then abdominal cavity. We do have a couple branches off the ascending aorta that you might have a tendency to forget about, but they're very important. What are the first two blood vessels branching off the aorta?
Coronary.
The coronary, right? The right and left coronary arteries. And then the arch, the first branch is the brachiocephalic, and then the left common carotid and the left subclavian, right? So that you're probably familiar with. Let's see what the next slide looks like. Oh, yeah, we see some. I'm going to zoom way in. All right, so the ones on the test that you have, this is probably an exam figure, but the only arteries that you have to know are what I've listed for you on the sheet right here. Okay? So, for instance, here's probably a left coronary artery right here, and here's a right coronary artery, ascending, arch, descending, brachiocephalic, left common carotid, left subclavian. Okay, and then the brachiocephalic bifurcates very early into what? Basically what we now see on the left side of the body, the left common carotid and the left subclavian. But there's another interesting artery that we see branching here, and it's almost the first one. It's this one right here. This one goes through the transverse processes of the vertebrae. What do the transverse processes of the cervical vertebrae have that none other vertebrae have? A thoracic vertebrae doesn't have these little gizmos. Their lumbar doesn't have them. And if I were to hold it up like this, you could actually tell me, even the people in the way in the back of the room could tell me because you could see them. They have what? Little foramina. They have little holes, right? They have holes in the transverse foramina. And we call what those the, I mean, the transverse processes, those we call the transverse foramina. And what goes through there? The vertebral artery and vertebral vein. So this first branch, right, off the subclavian right there is the vertebral artery. Now, why is that really important? Because that little guy helps you maintain consciousness. It feeds blood to your brain. That's got to be your favorite organ in your body. Okay, and without that blood flow, right, you're going to be really hurting. And it goes through the vertebrae to get to your brain. So there are two major blood vessels on at least one side of the body that brings blood to the brain. It is the carotid artery and the vertebral. Those are the only two. So you can't get a blockage in those guys. We'll see that maybe you can still survive depending, because there's a special feature of blood vessels in the brain that I'll show you in just a little bit. Yeah. Nope, that's different. I'm going to show you a picture of that in just a little bit. Okay. The carotid sinus is actually right here, right where I have the cursor right here. Okay, I don't think I have this on the word slide just yet, but here we have the common carotid on the right side, and then it's going to bifurcate to an external carotid and an internal carotid. The internal feeds your brain, the external carotid feeds all your facial muscles and your scalp, things on the outside of the cranium. Okay, so that's the difference between the internal and external carotid. And this junction right here is a carotid sinus. There's some important, when you get to a physiology class, there's some important little sensors right there that are always monitoring your blood pressure to make sure that it's normal. But that's a place, the carotid sinus, that's a place where there's a lot of disease. Just because of the way that vessel is built, it has a tendency to form plaques, and those plaques can break off and go to the brain, causing a stroke, for instance. But before a plaque breaks off, it's going to narrow. What happens to blood flow when there's a narrowing of that area because there's pathology, there's an inflammation or a plaque forming there? It goes down, right, by that fourth power rule. So a little occlusion of that blood vessel can turn off a major amount of flow to the brain. And so this area right here is probably the area that's imaged more than any other area in the human body, because it undergoes disease, and when it undergoes disease, it produces ischemic attacks, transient ischemic attacks, where people lose consciousness, or they might not go unconscious, but they'll forget where they are, who their family is, right, what they're doing at the moment, or it produces strokes. And so this is very easy area to image with ultrasound. And so there's people in the hospital all day long measuring people's carotid sinus with ultrasound, looking for plaques and disease and things like that. So the sinus is what? At the bifurcation of the external carotid and the internal carotid right here. All right, so here's that vertebral going up. Here is the subclavian. Subclavian means it's what? Under the clavicle. Yeah, under the clavicle. And clavicle is pretty easy bone to break. It doesn't have anywhere to go when it's traumatized because it's wedged right between the sternum and the scapula. Breaks pretty commonly. But here you have that huge blood vessel. How come we don't hear many people dying of a ruptured subclavian artery when they break a clavicle? Remember, it's kind of that S-shaped, and it just has a shape. When it's broken, it breaks out. It doesn't break in. Okay, so that's really handy, except when it breaks out, of course, it can break the skin, and you got a little bleeding there. And then the other thing is you probably always have a bump for the rest of your life right there, because we don't really shave it down afterwards. Okay, so subclavian, when we get to the armpit, we call that the axillary, right, because this is the axilla part of the body. So here's the axillary. And then in the arm, that is the brachial, right? So when I label a diagram, I got to be really careful where I put these lines because it could be ambiguous. What if I put it like right here? What would you call that? Yeah, I'm not sure what I would call it. Okay, it's like right in between. All right, so make sure you know, at least on this diagram, okay, these different arteries. All right, and then brachial bifurcates into this one right here. It doesn't look like it's labeled, but it's the lateral artery. That's the, take a guess, radial. And then the medial one is going to be the ulnar. right? And then you got the Palmer branches right here. I don't know if that's on your list. I think I'm really out of order compared to... Yeah, let's get... Oh, so I covered this. All right, I got to find some diagrams to talk about the carotids just a little bit. Okay, and then we'll go back to the thoracic aorta. There's your heart. Ah, here's a good one. All right, so this looks like we got the right side of the body. So here is brachiocephalic. Bifurcates into the subclavian, right? And then you got the, oh, what a pretty picture. Here's that vertebral going through the transverse foramina right there. Common carotid, here's the carotid sinus, right? And then you've got the external carotid and internal carotid right here. All right, so now let's see if I can find something that shows the vertebral and the internal carotid doing something. Ah, here it is right here. Oop, expanded it just a little bit too much. Let's go back. All right, so we got the right and left vertebral arteries, right, going through the transverse processes. They come together to form the basilar artery. What do we call that when vessels come together? Anastomosis, right? So here is an anastomosis at the base of the brain, right, the ventral side of the brain. And so both blood flows from both vertebrals form the basilar. And then look what happens right around the pituitary gland, right at the base of the brain, right at the optic chiasma. There is like a little circle that's formed right here. And then we can also see the internal carotids. So blood is coming from both internal carotids, both vertebrals via the basilar, and it forms this circle. So blood can flow in any direction around this circle, depending on the blood pressure. So if there is an occlusion of, for instance, this carotid artery, normally you would think, let's see if I can figure out, that's the left side of the brain. So if there is an occlusion of the left common carotid right here, usually you would think that the whole left side of the brain is going to run out of oxygen and is going to die. And of course, if that were to happen, I'm sure the person would die, right? But what can happen? Because of this, what we call the circle of Willis, blood coming up the basilar or the right common carotid can get to the left side of the brain via what? That circle of Willis. All right, so the circle of Willis kind of acts like a nerve plexus. What was the beauty of a nerve plexus?
Even if one part of the nerve...
one nerve.
Other
nerves can still direct action potentials or nerve impulses to get to eventually to the effector organ to bypass that site of injury. Right? So that's what the circle of Willis does. It allows for alternate routes for blood to take to bypass an occlusion. Right? So you might, I don't think you can get away with 100% blockage of a carotid artery, but you can get away maybe with a 40% blockage in the carotid sinus and still be okay. Right, as a result of this circle of Willis right here. Now, do I have you know the different parts of the circle of Willis? I'm not sure.
Yeah,
like the posterior communicating, right, artery right here, right, the anterior communicating right here. Those are the things that make up the circle of Willis. Because it's so important, right, we can't live without blood flow to our brain, not even for a couple seconds. Okay. Okay. All right, so you see I have some asterisks by the carotid sinus that feeds blood to the brain as well as the vertebral. That's the only two ways that blood can actually get into our brains. And then it gets circulated by the circle of Willis. Okay, upper limbs we talked about already. So let's go to the descending aorta. Okay, Yeah, where's the sign-in sheet at? It's around someplace. Yeah, it's up there. Yeah, pass it back down, and when it comes back down, grab it if you need it. Okay. Well, thank goodness you probably looked at the aorta already. So here is, I'm not going to show you any branches off the thoracic aorta. I don't know if you have to know any of those. But here is the abdominal aorta. And you should know some of the branches coming off the abdominal aorta. And it might look a little complicated at first, but it's really not too bad. As long as you realize how to kind of categorize the various branches off the abdominal aorta. The two general ways is to think of a branch as either being a paired branch or an unpaired branch. So what kind of arteries have paired branches? They're going to go to organs that you have pairs of. Like, give me some examples of organs that you have pairs of. Okay. Well, liver. Let's think of the liver for just a second. Okay, but I think I have one kidney right here. Okay, I have one liver right here. Okay, hold on. Okay, you have one liver right here. I don't have one over here on the left. I only got a liver on the right. So do we need paired branches to go to one liver? No, you only need one branch. All right, now kidneys. I still have a right one and a left one on opposite sides of my body. So guess what kind of arteries I need to get to both of those kidneys? I need a paired branch, right? So organs that you have two of, that you have bilaterally, like adrenal gland, kidney gland, gonads, ovary or testes, right? You have paired blood vessels too. Other organs that you only have one of, you only need one artery. You have an unpaired branch going to it. Give me an example of another organ you only have one of. Help me out here.
I have no idea.
How about stomach? How many stomachs do you have? One. How many pancreases do you have? Spleen. One, that's right. So you have unpaired branches going to those organs. All right. Lungs, that's pulmonary circulation. And indeed, you have two lungs, so you got a right and a left pulmonary artery. This is true. All right, so let's do the unpaired branches first. All right, and there's only three that we're going to ask you to know. The one that's very close to the so here's the diaphragm, right? That's closest to the diaphragm, this is what we call the celiac trunk. And the celiac trunk bifurcates to feed the stomach and spleen and part of the liver. I don't think we're going to ask you to know those different branches, but this one here, that's the celiac trunk. All right, and then here's another unpaired branch. Now, notice where they're coming off. They're coming off right on midline of the aorta. All right, so here's the superior mesenteric, and then here's one that is below it. That is the inferior mesenteric, right? So that's easy. Celiac, superior mesenteric, inferior mesenteric. All the others are paired branches, right, coming off bilaterally. Like, for instance, here's one going to the adrenal gland. So that's what we call the suprarenal artery. Supra means on top of. Anytime you hear renal, that means kidney. Okay, like the adrenal gland, right, is on top of the kidneys. Here's the kidney. Here's a paired branch going to the kidneys. Those would be the renal arteries. And then here's another paired branch here and here. These are going to go to either ovaries or testes, and so that would be the gonadal arteries, right and left gonadal. All right, so that's everything in the aorta, the abdominal aorta that you have to know about. So how's that? Pretty easy? Yeah, it's real easy. All right, now what happens to the aorta when it gets into the pelvic cavity? It disappears. But where does it go? Yeah, it bifurcates because you have two lower appendages. All right, so here's the here and here. It looks like one is a lot bigger than the other. I don't think it really should be. But after the bifurcation, then we call that the common iliac. And then there's going to be another bifurcation pretty quick. So this is going to be the external iliac, and then this is the internal iliac. Okay, so that's pretty easy. When we trace that's not an exam figure, but you could probably tell me the name of, is it on the slide? Oh, I was going to ask you. The name of this big artery that's going through this foramen right here. That's really easy. I could probably ask you without even showing you. That would be the obturator artery because it's going through the obturator foramen. Okay, so that's just a little common sense. All right, so you got internal iliac, external iliac. When that iliac goes into the thigh, it becomes the femoral. When it goes behind the knee, we call that the popliteal. Which ones do you have to know? That's it. Oh, that is so easy. Okay? That is so easy. All right, so you're done with arteries. All right, so what's a vascular anastomosis again? This is where blood vessels unite, right? Blood flow is coming together. What's the neuronal equivalent of a vascular anastomosis? I suppose you could say what, a plexus, nerve plexus. What's the function of a vascular anastomosis? This allows for distribution of blood from various vessels to get to a target tissue, right? It can overcome disease processes. All right, let's talk about veins for just a little bit. So again, just make sure you know the definition of a vein. It's returning blood back to the heart. Some veins carry oxygen, some don't. Give me the name of a vein that is high in oxygen.
Pulmonary
vein. Very good. You should be really familiar with that now. Okay, and the nice thing about veins is once you know arteries, you pretty much know the names of veins. Right? Only a few places in the body do they change. One good exception, okay, would be, for instance, the major arteries in the neck. What are the major arteries in the neck? No, the major arteries. Yeah, the arteries. Arteries. The carotid, yeah, the common carotid and maybe external, okay. Now, the veins aren't called carotid veins, all right? This is what you're already telling me the answer, but I wanted to just step through it. What's the name of the vein in your neck? It's not a carotid vein, it's a
jugular.
So that's one place where you have to change the name of that blood vessel, right? Okay, so you got an internal and external jugular. Oh, I didn't get there yet. I need to talk about the head. All right, so just generally speaking, know the names of arteries, and that will help you know the names of veins in most places of the body. All right, now what about the head? Here we go. Okay, so since we talked about the neck, let's talk about the neck. Here is the internal jugular. Okay, there's that vertebral vein. Here is the external jugular. And probably you'll do a dissection of a cat, and you'll dissect out this internal jugular. That's a nice, easy dissection right there. And you're also going to find within that same area, within the same sheath, is going to be the common carotid artery and the vagus nerve. Have you ever heard of a vagus nerve before?
No.
What's that for? It does what to the heart? It decreases heart rate, decreases, so it inhibits the heart. All right, so if this was a real patient you were working on and not just a cat, when you started digging around in there, if you were to stimulate the vagus nerve just by poking around, what might you do to your patient? You might freeze his heart. You might slow his heart rate down so much that it actually stops beating, right? So that's just a little physiology for fun. Okay. All right, but in the brain, let's look at this diagram over here. In the brain, okay, there were structures in the brain between the layers of the dura mater that collected blood, and those were called what? The dural sinuses. The dural sinuses are huge veins that are draining blood back from the brain. And the brain, remember, is highly metabolic all the time, so it receives a lot of blood, and so it's draining a lot of blood continuously. All right, so here's the superior sagittal sinus that drains blood right into from the straight sinus over here, right, that forms then the transverse sinus, and that receives blood from the anterior part of the brain via the cavernous sinus, and these are all going to drain into what, the internal jugular vein. All right, so these are all just huge sinuses, right, not within the neuronal tissue, but within the meninges themselves. Okay. So I think maybe this is an exam figure that you have to know. Superior sagittal sinus, the straight sinus. These form right here at the junction of the sinuses that forms a transverse sinus. That's a huge vein, and that's going to be joined by the cavernous sinus, and then that's going to flow into the jugular vein. Okay. Let's see, in the chest, well, you have intercostals. You have intercostal arteries. Where are they going to, what are they going to supply?
Ribs,
intercostals, meaning between the ribs, the muscles between the ribs, okay? Let's see, hemiazygos, I don't think I'm going to show you this. An azygos, these are veins that are just draining blood from the thoracic cavity back into the heart, okay? The lower appendage, you've got the femoral, deep femoral, and great saphenous. All right, so that great saphenous, can you remember, could you tell me about where it was from your labs? It is what, medial thigh, but it's very superficial. Okay. All right, let's talk about some special circulations for just a little bit. So what's a general kind of circulation that we've looked at so far? Yeah, you got systemic and pulmonary, and both of these kind of follow this architecture. Right, so you got a blood vessel that's taking blood away from the heart. What do we call that? Artery. All right. And then here is a blood vessel bringing blood back to the heart. What do we call that? Okay, here's a vein. And what do you got in between?
Capillary.
You got a capillary. What's special about a capillary? Exchange takes place. That's right. Which has got the highest blood pressure? Which is the lowest? That's right. Okay. Now, how many capillary beds do you see between an artery and a vein? There's one. Okay. That's not always the case. It is the case 99.9% of the time, right? But every once in a while, there is going to be an artery that feeds a capillary bed. So here is a capillary bed. And then it coalesces into something that looks a lot like a vein. But then, you know what? Here comes another capillary bed. All right, so here's a capillary. So we call this capillary number one, and this is going to be capillary number two. There are two capillaries back to back. All right, so this is what we call a portal circulation. And this is pretty cool because it's a special delivery system. It will pick something up in capillary bed number one, and instead of taking it to the heart and through your whole circulation before it gets to another capillary bed, it takes it from capillary bed directly to capillary bed number two. And what can it do in capillary bed number two? If it enters here, it can leave here. All right, so it's like a door-to-door special delivery system. All right, now where you have these things, for instance, maybe you're going to be absorbing things in your stomach right here. And these might be like some toxic materials, like maybe, I don't know, ethyl alcohol. But actually, every time you eat a plant like broccoli, broccoli doesn't want to be eaten by animals. It produces toxins to protect itself. It's just that we have enzymes in a certain part of our body that can detoxify that material before it causes problems for us. So we absorb food that we eat in our stomach and intestines, capillary bed number two, and then that blood doesn't go back to the heart. Where does it have to go to first? It's capillary bed number two, in particular in the liver. And then that blood is detoxified, and then blood flows out of the liver via the hepatic vein back to the inferior vena cava, to the heart that joins your regular circulation. Yeah.
Is that where they only take place, the stomach and abdomen?
That's not the only place.
Okay.
In terms of a portal circulation, I'm going to give you two other examples.
And those are like the main ones.
These are the main ones that you should know. Okay. So this little vein that's connecting the two capillary beds, that's a portal vessel. That's a portal vessel. And since it's going to the liver, we would call that the hepatic portal vein, right? Hepatic portal vein. That's where it is. Between the intestines and the liver, that helps detoxify materials. All right, so where else do we have these special portal circulations? All right, we got them in the nephron. All right, that's a part of the kidney. When we get to the kidney soon, next week, okay, we're going to see there's another portal circulation. And when I say portal, what does that mean? two capillary beds back to back, right? Another important place is what we call the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. So where's the hypothalamus at? Let's see if I can draw this. Oh, yeah, okay, it's coming back to me. Brain, very good. All right, so where's the hypothalamus? Hypothalamus is maybe right about here? No, that's thalamus. Here's hypothalamus. That's the hypothalamus. And what's underneath the hypothalamus? Pituitary. As a matter of fact, it's going to be the anterior pituitary. All right, well, there are the capillary beds here in the hypothalamus that pick up little tiny hormones and deliver them directly into the anterior pituitary, where there's another capillary bed. And it's going to signal these cells to do something, and then these cells release other hormones that tell other endocrine glands in your body what to do. Like, for instance, this is going to go to, what gland does this look like? That's your thyroid gland. You maybe would recognize that from lab since you're doing respiratory system. There's a thyroid gland. The thyroid gland gets directions from the anterior pituitary, but the anterior pituitary gets directions from your brain, namely the hypothalamus. So here's capillary bed number one in the hypothalamus. Here's capillary bed number two in the pituitary, which then carries signals to the thyroid gland. Now what is this little tissue right here between the hypothalamus and the pituitary called? There's a vessel, but that's the blood vessel. But what's the name of that tissue, though? It's the stalk. What's another name for the stalk? You said it. You were right. The infundibulum, right? That's the infundibulum has got the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal vessel running through it. Okay. Now, what did I call that in class? That was really fun. Peduncolito. That's right. I call that a peduncolito. Okay, that's got the portal vessel going through it, yeah.
Is there ever more than two capillary
beds? I don't know an example where there's ever more than two, where there would be three or four or anything like that. Two would do it, okay. But I always keep an open mind, right? Okay. All right, so the hepatic portal system, here is a nice example of it. You've got the celiac trunk supplying blood to the stomach. Capillary bed in the stomach picks up material. Then the gastric vein empties blood into the superior mesenteric vein. Into the gastric vein. But these other veins from the small intestine and from the spleen don't go back to the vena cava. It goes into the hepatic portal vein, which takes it to liver capillaries. That's capillary bed number two. And that blood flows out of the circulatory system and around the cells of the liver. So the capillaries of the liver are the leakiest kind. What kind of capillaries are the leakiest? The sinusoidal capillaries. So the liver has these extremely leaky capillaries called sinusoids. Okay, and that blood flows around these liver cells. And the liver cells, lost my cursor, where is it? The liver cells then detoxify the blood. Then blood flows out of the liver via the inferior vena cava, or the hepatic veins, into the inferior vena cava, back to the right atrium. Okay. Maybe I could talk to you about that in just a little bit. But I need to finish up the fetal circulation. All right, you're probably familiar with that already from lab. Right, because you had a test on that. But that, I think, is an exam figure in here. Where is the fetal circulation? Now, is that really complicated? Oh, here, look. What is this? Ah, look, I didn't realize you had that slide. What kind of circulation is that? Before you go, you got to tell me what kind of circulation that is. What kind of circulation is that? Two capillary beds back to back. That's a portal circulation. Thank you. That's a portal circulation. Special delivery from one capillary to the next capillary. Okay, fetal circulation. Okay, now, when you're a fetus, what organ don't you really need in your body? You don't need your lungs, right? Because what organ is taking the job of your lungs? Or what organ is doing the job of your lungs? It's the placenta, right? So now what can you tell me about the circulation to the lungs in an adult compared to the circulation of your systemic circulation? It's what? Is it the same in terms of what arteries carry and veins carry?
No.
Okay. The pulmonary circulation is what? Opposite, right? Arteries are deoxygenated, veins are oxygenated. The same thing for the fetal circulation. The vessels that are going to the placenta are what? Those are arteries, but is that oxygenated or deoxygenated? Just like the lungs, that's deoxygenated. Placental veins or umbilical veins, because they're not, that blood is now oxygenated, those veins are oxygenated. So when you think of fetal circulation, kind of mirror it or model it like you would the pulmonary circulation, right, to help your understanding of it. All right, so what are some differences? You don't need blood going to the lungs. So here is blood, right, in the right atrium. Blood shouldn't go into the pulmonary circulation, but it can go from the right atrium into the left atrium. So there's a hole in a heart between in the interatrial septum. What's that called? That's the fossovallus, right? And then when you're born, that hole closes over, but it leaves a little depression. I'm sorry. Okay, I said it wrong. Okay. I have to not just listen, I have to think. You always have to think a little bit. All right, before you're born, the hole is not called the fossa ovalis, it's called the, what's a hole called in anatomy called? It's a foramen, right? It's called the foramen ovale. And then when you're born, the foramen closes over, at least in most cases, right? But it forms a little depression. What's a depression? That's a fossa. All right, so that's called the fossa ovalis. So in the adult, you have a little depression in the interatrial septum. That's the fossa ovalis. Okay, so the other thing is, too, also before you're born, if any blood does leave the pulmonary trunk, it doesn't need to go to the lungs. It could be diverted directly into the aorta. So there's a little passageway between the pulmonary artery and the aorta, which we call the ductus arteriosus, because these are arteries. And then when you're born, what happens to the ductus arteriosus? It becomes the, this sounds like Harry Potter novel. It becomes what? It becomes a ligament, so we call it the ligamentum arteriosum. All right, so the ductus arteriosus becomes the ligamentum arteriosum. All right. Now, so blood is going to come down the aorta, okay, and some of it's going to be diverted into the umbilical arteries. This is relatively deoxygenated blood, and because it's going to pick up blood in the placenta, all right, and it picks up blood in the placenta, and then it returns oxygenated via the umbilical vein. Okay, and what does the umbilical vein become? It becomes the ligamentum teres after you're born. And then blood doesn't, so it's coming back close to your liver, but it doesn't have to actually go into the liver. It can bypass the liver because guess what the placenta is doing? It's doing the major job of the liver as well. Okay. And so it bypasses the liver, so it takes the ductus venosus into the inferior vena cava. And then when you're born, the ductus venosus turns into the ligamentum venosum. It turns into another ligament. All right, so I think that's the major differences between the fetal circulation and the adult circulation. Okay, this is probably an exam figure. I'm not going to ask you probably to label anything except those five structures that change between the fetal circulation and the adult circulation. So you don't have to pick out like the brachiocephalic, et cetera, and the common iliac and all that kind of stuff. All right, so you should be pretty familiar with that. All right, so who needs a sign-in sheet? Anybody? You're all good with that? Okay. That's it for lecture today. Thanks for your attention.